Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Harvard University Professor of Law Lonnie Guinier, who assesses the recent Supreme Court decision upholding the University of Michigan's affirmative action admissions policy promoting educational diversity. Ohio Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich, who discusses his candidacy and his demand for an investigation into possible White House manipulation of intelligence prior to the U.S. war on Iraq. And Jack Cole of the group Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, who takes a critical look at the war against drugs, considered by an increasing number of police officials as a public policy failure. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports that 65 million people worldwide could die from contamination generated by nuclear energy and weapons plants that operated prior to 1989. The startling forecast comes from a new study released by the European Committee on Radiation Risk that directly challenges the work of the International Commission on Radiological Protection, the main authority on the health risks from radiation. The commission is accused by other scientists of underestimating the harm of exposure from low-level radiation. Specifically, the ECRR reports a spike in breast cancer rates in women who were teenagers between 1957 and 1963, a period of intense above-ground nuclear testing. Carolyn Lucas, a Green Party member of the European Parliament, proclaimed, "These shocking new findings give the nuclear debate a renewed urgency. People are dying and continue to die in the millions." The 1986 Chernobyl accident was the world's worst nuclear disaster, resulting in devastating casualties and illness. An Irish charity, the Chernobyl Children's Project, warns that children exposed to heavy radiation during the Chernobyl disaster are more likely to develop cases of thyroid cancer, and incidents of genetic mutations among newborns are also increasing. As project founder Adi Roach noted, the rate of congenital birth deformities is frighteningly high. According to Mother Jones magazine, U.S. companies are using legal loopholes to trade with terrorist-sponsoring nations. These companies use offshore subsidiaries to trade with countries barred by economic sanctions like Iran, North Korea, Libya, and Sudan. Other U.S. firms, including Hewlett-Packard, Kodak, and Procter & Gamble, skirt sanctions by shipping products to Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, where third parties can re-export goods to Iran. While the U.S. State Department calls Iran the most active state sponsor of terrorism, General Electric is providing the country with four hydroelectric generators through its Canadian subsidiary, GE Hydro. Through an Italian unit called Nuove Pignone, GE supplies Iran with pipeline compressors and gas turbines. Vice President Dick Cheney's former company, Halliburton, is contributing to a $228 million fertilizer plant in Iran and, through a Swedish division, a $226 million drill rig. While both the Reagan and Clinton administrations worked to put an end to sanction dodging, the Bush administration has made it easier for American corporations to trade with the same countries it has targeted in the war on terrorism. Cheney has issued a comprehensive assessment of sanctions as part of the National Energy Review that suggests relaxing sanctions against oil-producing nations to benefit, quote, energy security. In 2001, the National Foreign Trade Council spent $280,000 lobbying against sanctions. Regardless of Bush's lax policies toward corporate lawbreaking, the sanctions enjoy broad bipartisan support in Congress. Representative Frank Wolf, a Republican from Virginia, said, "By doing business in these countries, you are basically selling the rope that will be used to harm U.S. citizens." On Friday, June 25th, shortly before 5 a.m., five FBI agents entered the home of Nilda Medina and Robert Rabin, members of the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques, with a warrant to arrest Medina, accusing her of violation of Title 18 of the Federal Code for Damage to Property. Puerto Rican police were also involved in the operation that was headed by Agent Teodoro Lebron. According to spokespersons for the committee, during the same time, federal agents arrested several others in Vieques, including Jose Montanez Sanes, brother of David Sanes, killed by an errant U.S. bomb on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques in 1999, and the ex-president of the Puerto Rico Teachers Federation, Jesus Delgado Burgos. Some of those arrested were charged with conspiracy to destroy government property, and all the charges are related to the events of May 1st of this year, when the people of Vieques marked the official end of 60 years of U.S. Navy bombing there. 8 of those arrested were released on condition of payment of $5,000 bail. Jose Sanas was detained in federal prison at Guaynabo and awaits a hearing to determine if he will be allowed a $50,000 bail. The arrest came 4 days after the FBI agents entered the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques office at the Peace and Justice Camp with a search warrant, and the day before the 11th Annual People's Assembly of the group. Critics charged the arrests were an attempt to divert attention and criminalize the struggle of the people of Vieques, who demand control of the demilitarization, decontamination, devolution, and sustainable development of this small island. This week's news summary was compiled by Britta Brundage, Denise Manzari, and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
In a landmark decision handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court on June 23rd, the justices upheld by a 5-4 vote the University of Michigan's affirmative action admissions policy employed by the law school to promote educational diversity. While turning back the first major challenge to affirmative action in 25 years, the court in a 6-3 ruling struck down the University of Michigan's undergraduate admissions system, which relied on points awarded to minority applicants. Opponents of affirmative action had a powerful ally in the Bush administration, which had sent U.S. Solicitor General Theodore Olson to argue unsuccessfully before the court that university admission systems which take race into account are unconstitutional. But a well-organized national coalition of college students, civil rights activists, members of the U.S. military, and some major corporations proclaimed their support for the goal of achieving diversity and equal opportunity throughout America's institutions of higher learning. Writing the majority opinion in the law school case, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor stated that, in order to cultivate a set of leaders with legitimacy in the eyes of the citizenry, it is necessary that the path to leadership be visibly open to talented and qualified individuals of every race and ethnicity. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Harvard University Professor of Law Lonnie Guinier, who assesses the recent Supreme Court decision, viewed by many as an important victory for the civil rights struggle in America.
It's definitely a victory because the Supreme Court nailed shut, I hope permanently, but certainly for the time being, the tendency of those on the right to conflate every discussion of race with an unconstitutional or illegal or at least odious quota. So what the affirmative action decisions do is to suggest that racial diversity can be a compelling governmental interest, and the fact that a governmental decision maker is using race as one of many factors in trying to decide whom to admit to a public institution is not in and of itself a quota, and in fact, it's a compelling governmental interest to think about racial diversity.
In the pair of decisions handed down by the Supreme Court, the justices struck down the University of Michigan's undergraduate admissions system where points were awarded for race. What impact do you think that will have on universities as they try to stay within the bounds that the court actually set up here for them to comply with diversity that's constitutional?
Well, I think it's an invitation for universities to be much more creative, to either invest a lot of money in hiring admissions officers who can read 20,000 applications, or in doing something like the University of Texas Austin has already done, which is to admit a percentage of the students around the state who are in the top 10%, for example, of their high school class. And given the combination of both the law school decision and the undergraduate decision, such universities, including the University of Texas in Austin, can use the top 10% as a pool of eligible candidates and then select from among those candidates who will contribute to the diversity of the school. So I think there are many ways in which universities can comply with the decision. On the other hand, I do worry that the decision makes it appear as if there's a value in being opaque about what universities are doing. And in that sense, I agree with the dissent of Justice Ginsburg that honesty should be the best policy and that we shouldn't be hiding what universities are doing. We should be making sure that what they're doing is democratically accountable. And there's really no discussion of that in the court's opinion.
And just a final question for you here. It seems with this very close decision in the affirmative action case before the Supreme Court, the stakes are very high when it comes to the 2004 presidential election, where it seems the next resident of the White House is going to have the power to appoint some new justices if, as we hear, some of the justices may retire in the coming years. What is at stake exactly, in your view, with the Supreme Court in terms of future decisions and civil liberties issues that are certainly coming to the fore now in the wake of September 11th and the Homeland Security regime?
Most people in my situation, that is law professors or legal scholars, when asked that question, and also human rights, civil rights, women's rights activists, would say that the fate of the world hangs by a slender thread tied to Justice O'Connor's future on the Supreme Court, because she is the key swing vote. And I don't disagree that her vote has been crucial in saving some of the advances that women and people of color have made over the past two or three decades. On the other hand, I think that her decision in the Grutter case, in the affirmative action cases, suggests that Supreme Court justices read the newspaper and they respond to developments in the world around them. And her decision seemed very much influenced by the overwhelming number of amicus curiae briefs that were filed, suggesting that many people think diversity is a very good thing for the United States. That says to me there's a role for ordinary people in helping to determine the fate of legal jurisprudence. This is not just about justices sitting in their black robes trying to decide what the law is, but it's also about ordinary people making it clear by their actions, by mobilizing collectively around things that they believe in, that the world is changing and that the court has to respond to those changes in the world. So just the fact that the court overruled a decision that they had rendered in 1986 suggests that the court does respond to changing cultural norms and to efforts, to activism by ordinary people.
That was Harvard University Professor of Law Lonnie Guinier. Contact Harvard University's Civil Rights Project at area code 617-496-6367 or visit their website at www.civilrightsproject.harvard.edu. Of the nine announced Democratic presidential candidates, Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich has emerged as a passionate activist on a number of issues important to progressives inside and outside the party. As chairman of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Kucinich led the fight in the House of Representatives last fall against legislation authorizing President Bush to use force in Iraq. Though he and his allies lost that vote, the tally was closer than many had predicted. The congressman has for several years advocated the creation of a cabinet-level Department of Peace. Dennis Kucinich became known nationally in 1977 when he was elected mayor of Cleveland at the age of 31, the youngest person ever to lead a major American city. But when Kucinich resisted the demand of powerful banks to privatize the city's publicly owned electrical utility, the banks declared Cleveland in default, causing him to lose his reelection bid in 1979. Since entering Congress in 1996, Dennis Kucinich has been a tireless campaigner for labor rights, universal health care, fair trade, sustainable development, and protection of the environment. Although dismissed by the corporate media as a long shot, the Kucinich campaign received a boost recently when the candidate captured second place after former Vermont Governor Howard Dean in an online poll conducted by MoveOn.org, an internet-based activist group. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dennis Kucinich about his candidacy and allegations now being leveled at the Bush administration that they had exaggerated or misrepresented intelligence they used to justify the war against Iraq.
The campaign keeps picking up. We're gathering momentum. We're getting endorsements. Second place finish in the MoveOn.org gave us a chance to demonstrate the real ability to attract support from around the country. So the campaign's going just great, and as more and more people go to our website at Kucinich.us, the involvement just keeps spreading. I'm excited.
What's the significance of your second place showing in the MoveOn.org poll? Is that something that people should stand up and take note of?
Well, I got 76,000 votes. I mean, you don't get 76,000 votes in that kind of a process unless you have substantial support. And I think the reason why I finished second out of nine candidates is because my campaign has struck a responsive chord among people all over the country, because I've been the only one to stand up to this bloated Pentagon budget, to this cause of war of this administration, to the shift of priorities that they've created by invoking fear in this country. And as I continue to do that, I'm confident that more and more people will see that it's my candidacy which will bring about the kind of fundamental change which Americans really aspire to. Americans want a country which is fearless. They want a country which has jobs for all, health care for all, and education for all. And I make the connection. My candidacy makes the connection between the aspirations of people and challenging this administration's march to war on fraudulent premises and their insistence on keeping this country in a condition of fear.
Representative Kucinich, you were one of the leaders in Congress against the march to war that the Bush administration led this nation on. Now that the war, at least the first phase of the war, is over and there is continuing conflict there, what is the role of Congress now in doing the oversight about the allegations that the rationales offered by and the justifications offered by the Bush administration were not wholly honest with the American people? And then, of course, we've got mounting casualties on the field there daily from Iraq.
Well, the war is not over. And Congress has a fundamental responsibility to ensure the administration is accountable with respect to the statements that were made about Iraq representing an imminent threat, accountable for the climate that was created that caused Americans to believe that Iraq had something to do with 9/11, with the anthrax attack on this country, or with Al-Qaeda's role in 9/11. This administration has a lot of explaining to do to the American people. Where are those weapons of mass destruction that constituted an imminent threat to this nation? And so Congress and Congress alone has a constitutional responsibility as a co-equal branch of government in a system that depends on checks and balances for Congress to be the check on the aggressive assertions of this administration, for Congress to balance the energies of our nation away from the war path and towards the path to peace, which is the only way that we can rescue America's role in the world and America's capacity to meet the needs of people here at home.
With the Republicans leading both the House and Senate, is there any chance the Bush administration will be scrutinized to the point where we really will know the truth about what happened with the rationales with the war?
Well, we already know the answer to that. The International Relations Committee, under the leadership of the House Republicans, declined a resolution of inquiry which sought information from the administration on their basis for going to war against Iraq, sought the information with respect to the nature of the threat, sought the information with respect to the details as to why the administration had to launch a military attack when it did. Furthermore, the House Republicans recently frustrated an amendment that would have caused Vice President Cheney and the CIA to have to offer the information about the nature of the Vice President's frequent visits to CIA analysts who then came up with, some said, were reports that essentially cooked the books over intelligence. Republicans apparently are more intent on holding power than they are on getting to the truth of our involvement in Iraq. And I think they're doing it at peril. Because as the American people come to understand that we've been led into a war based on false premises, and they understand that a political party is blocking access to the truth, There may even be a lot of good office holders, people who have been good public servants, who could find themselves caught up in the backlash that's sure to be generated when the American people learn that there's an attempt to stonewall the search for the truth and an attempt to cover up on behalf of an administration that led this nation into a war without any justification whatsoever. We need to work with the world community so that the United States can begin to slowly and deliberately extract ourselves from this major presence that we have in Iraq. The United States cannot let the cause of war in Iraq be the cause of war profiteering for the Bechtels and the Halliburtons. We have to regain our moral authority, and the only way we do that is work with the world community.
That was Ohio Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich. Contact his campaign office at area code 866-413-3664 or visit his website at www.kucinich.us. Increasingly, the United States' so-called war on drugs is being recognized as a stunning failure of public policy. Laws which criminalize substance abuse are a major factor in America's high rate of incarceration, where more than 2 million of its citizens languish behind bars, a majority of them nonviolent offenders. While there are many critiques of the drug war, one of the most powerful comes from those who work or have worked in the ranks of law enforcement. Jack Cole is a 26-year veteran of the New Jersey State Police. For 12 of those years, Cole worked as an undercover narcotics officer. During his career, he investigated street drug use, mid-level narcotics dealers, and international billion-dollar drug trafficking organizations. After retiring, Cole says he began dealing with the emotional fallout resulting from his participation in the drug war by working to reform current drug laws. Last year, Cole, along with 5 others, founded LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, which now has more than 400 members nationwide, including current and former police officers, judges, and elected officials. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Cole at a recent conference on wrongful convictions held in New Haven, Connecticut, where he was the featured speaker. He explained how the drug war has corrupted police officials and discussed the main goals of his organization.
Police, for the most part, get promoted by the number of arrests they make. Sure, we have tests that you take, so on and so forth, but if two people take the same test and come out almost exactly the same or exactly the same, what breaks the tie is the number of arrests that one or the other has made. When the war on drugs was created, it made very, very easy arrests. There's nothing hard at all about going out there and arresting somebody for some sort of nonviolent drug violation. The people are everywhere. After all, 87 million people in this country above the age of 12 have used an illegal drug. We are not judged by the number of convictions we get, only by the number of arrests. And that creates a thing where people will go out and stop a car with maybe 5 young people in the car and find a baggie of marijuana under the seat or a glassine bag with heroin or cocaine, just a one-person dose. And they pulled it up in the air and they say, who belongs to this? And of course, all 5 people say, I never saw that before in my life. And probably 4 of them are telling the truth, at least. And could be all 5 of them are telling the truth, right? Somebody could have left it in there before these people even got in the car. But the police officer's answer to that is almost invariably, then you're all under arrest. Now, what that does is you have 5 young folks who have arrest records for possession of, say, heroin. That's a pretty hefty thing. Now, the police officer goes back and he submits the evidence and he writes up his report, sends it in the prosecutor's office. The report doesn't even hit the prosecutor's desk before he gets thrown in the trash, virtually, because no prosecutor is going to take that to a grand jury today. So you've got 5 people that have a criminal record of arrest, and whenever they're stopped again, when we call in from a car stop on our radios and say, check out Johnny Jones, will you? Date of birth such and such. We don't get back a conviction status. We only get back an arrest status on this person. So it'll make it much, much harder for all these young folks in the future. You know, we are arresting every year 1.6 million people for nonviolent drug arrests. You know how much 1.6 million people is? It's the population of New Mexico. So just imagine, every year we arrest the population of New Mexico for nonviolent drug arrests. I think there's a better way. My organization, which is LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, was created last July to give voice to all the current and former members of law enforcement who believe the war on drugs is a dismal failure and who want to support alternative policies that will do four things. Lessen the incidence of death, disease, crime, and addiction. Four categories that the war on drugs just inflates, each one of them, makes much worse. We believe in legalization of drugs, legalizing them so that they can be controlled and regulated.
Do you make a distinction between legalization and not decriminalization?
Absolutely. You have to legalize it if you're going to end it. We didn't decriminalize alcohol in 1933. We legalized alcohol. We ended alcohol prohibition. And during alcohol prohibition, murders in the U.S. attained the highest rate ever in our history until now. We had the highest corruption of officials in this country ever during alcohol prohibition until now. We might be surpassing that now because there's a lot more money to be made out there even than there was during alcohol prohibition.
And when you say officials, can you say a little more about, you mean police officers or their supervisors or civilian elected officials?
Let me put it to you this way. Do you know how much money is spent to buy drugs in the world each year, annually? $400 billion. That is 8% of the gross product of the entire world. And I would suggest to you that is enough money not just to bribe a cop or a judge or a politician or a banker, all of which have been done in mass. That's enough money to buy whole countries, literally. People who have fought this war for all these years, like I fought it for 26 years, have learned it's a failure. And when it's been failing for so long, we have to look for alternatives.
That was Jack Cole of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Contact LEAP by calling area code 781-393-6985 or visit their website at www.leap.cc. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.